Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks very much for being with us today. There is an exhibit that has opened at the Oshkosh Public Museum. It runs through the 12th of October and traces the lives of Abe Lincoln and Russian Tsar Alexander II. Marilyn Sweezy of Washington, D.C. is one of two curators of this traveling exhibit at the Oshkosh Public Museum, and she is a guest curator of the exhibition and an independent art historian and curator which specializes in Russian decorative arts and cultural history. And Marilyn Sweezy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Jim. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And David McDonald is professor of Russian history, chair of the history department at the UW-Madison, and has recently returned from a visit to Russia.
That's correct, Jim. Nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. Did you get a chance to go to any of the art museums in Russia?
Yeah, I saw the Tretyakov Gallery in Moscow and saw the Hermitage and the Russian Museum in St. Petersburg.
Had a fabulous trip, I understand.
Yes, it was gorgeous.
Marilyn, tell me what led to this traveling exhibit, which traces the lives of President Lincoln and Russian Tsar Alexander II?
Well, it was originally the idea of Mr. Jim Symington, the Honorable James Symington, who is the chairman of the board of the American-Russian Cultural Cooperation Foundation, which has organized this exhibit. And Jim has been a very enthusiastic Russophile for many years and traveled to Russia from the days it was the Soviet Union. And he's also very interested in the Lincoln side of American history because he is the great-grandson of John Hay, who was one of Lincoln's private secretaries. So he had the idea several years ago of doing an exhibition comparing these two leaders. And the museum directors in Russia thought it was a wonderful idea, and people here have been interested in it. It is actually a very little-known story, certainly missing in our history books, and very much unknown in Russia as well.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Tsar and the President had in common, because they had very disparate backgrounds.
Oh, they certainly did. They came from very opposite backgrounds. But once they came to power, there was, if one can say that, in the case of Russia, it was power. In the case of the United States, elected leadership. But once they came into the leadership of their countries, there was a lot in common, as it happened. The first thing they both did on coming into the position of leadership was to liberate enslaved peoples. For the Tsar, who acceded to the throne of Russia on the death of his father, Nicholas I, in 1855, almost immediately he began to speak to the State Council and the nobility of Moscow about the need to abolish serfdom, that is, to free the enserfed peasantry of Russia. And he said in one of these speeches, "I view the case of emancipation as a vital issue for Russia. Any further delay may be fatal for the state." And we have, in fact, this speech, the outline of which is handwritten by him, in our exhibition, loaned from the state archive. And, of course, in 1861, he was able to sign and issue the Manifesto of Liberation. It was read in the Uspensky Cathedral in the Kremlin on February 19, 1861, and then was ordered to be read on all of the landowners' estates, notifying the peasantry of their freedom. We do have a period copy of the manifesto in the exhibition. We have a very interesting chromolithograph of the manifesto being read on one of the landowners' estates, and peasants are gathered around listening. Alexander, of course, was very much associated in Russian history with that idea. He's known as the Tsar Liberator, even to this day. And, of course, for Lincoln, we know that his concern for slavery went back many years before he was ever even campaigning for the presidency. He was very troubled in his youth by what he observed of the ill treatment of slaves when he traveled down the Mississippi and to areas where there was slavery. And when he came to the presidency in 1860, of course, very soon after, slavery and the secession of the Confederate States became an issue that led to the Civil War. But he very courageously, in 1863, confirmed slavery as a major issue in that war when he issued the Emancipation Proclamation. We have in the exhibition a very poignant exhibit in one of the cases of a set of slave shackles and collars that were used. I must say, for all of us installing the exhibition, it was a very shocking and rather poignant thing to view, and I think people will find that also. We also have a period copy of the Emancipation Proclamation in the exhibit. But that's perhaps the major parallel, but there are others as well.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the second striking parallel is the assassination that ended both of their lives, very much as a result of their liberation and emancipation. Of course, Lincoln, as I think every American student knows, was assassinated in April of 1865. He was shot on the 14th of April and died the next morning on the 15th in his late 50s. Alexander II lived quite a bit longer. He was assassinated on the 1st of March, 1881, after six previous attempts by revolutionary terrorist groups. There was one in particular called the People's Will, and they eventually, on March 1st, 1881, threw a bomb at his carriage as it was on its way back to the Winter Palace, where, they did not know this, he was about to sign a constitution, which, of course, remained forever unsigned.
Anything to add, David, regarding the Tsar and his emancipation of Serbs?
Well, a couple of things I'd add is, first, the magnitude of the achievement by the Russian emperor, your listeners should know that Alexander II signing the proclamation abolishing serfdom is something akin to if Jefferson Davis had signed the Emancipation Proclamation, that his interests, his social background, indeed his way of looking at the world, allied him, bound him hand and foot to the nobility, and which leads to the second thing, that we remember these things as sort of ringing moments. And watersheds in respective national histories, but we often lose sight of how negotiated and at least in the Russian case, how much this outcome was the product of bureaucratic maneuvering and negotiation by a small group of officials we would now call enlightened, who recognized that Russia's ability, the reason the emancipation took place as much as anybody can determine is it was designed to make Russia competitive in the international order. They just suffered a defeat at the hands of industrial Great Britain and industrial France, and this put paid to the notion that had long been held in the Russian Empire that that their system was superior. It was the system that had beaten Napoleon. It guaranteed order and social harmony. All this was pummeled to powder in places like Sevastopol and Balaclava. So, and finally, the third thing. Going back to Marilyn's discussion of the assassination of Alexander II, the extreme ambivalence that that greeted it when it took place, like most political outcomes, it pleased virtually nobody. For instance, landowners, the reading of the proclamation outside, once it got into the countryside, was ordered for Palm Sunday, which is the last Sunday of the fast before Easter, because there was strong apprehension that the peasants would not be thrilled at the terms of the emancipation. They expected, as far as we can tell, that landowners would relinquish all the land they held, and it would go to the peasants, who they saw as the rightful owners. The peasants saw as the rightful owners because they worked it, whereas the landowners, by their view, didn't. And they also expected they would be immediately free. In point of fact, they ended up having to pay for the land that they received out of the landowner's property. They assumed responsibility for something like a mortgage, a bond that they paid off that was originally designed to be fully amortized by 1919, I think it was, or 1921. They were also subject to a period of what was called temporary obligation, that they were obliged to continue performing the services they had for the landlord under serfdom. So when Alexander II was assassinated, he was assassinated by young radical terrorists, as was rightly pointed out, who felt that the emancipation had not gone far enough.
And yes, Marilyn?
Yes, if I could just add
one
thing to that. Yes, that's quite right. And I think the underlying motive for the people's will was the abolishing of the autocracy. They really wanted to get rid of the autocracy in Russia.
This exhibition is underway now. It opened last weekend. Tell me a little bit about the ceremonies that took place, Marilyn.
Oh, it was lovely, really. Fortunately, the weather shined upon us, and it did not rain because it was held outside in the large front garden of the Oshkosh Public Museum, which is a wonderful turn-of-the-previous-century mansion. The exhibition is set in the drawing rooms, library, and dining room of the mansion, which gives it a very nice period context, with paneled walls and brocaded covering and wainscoting, and it really provides a lovely background for these artifacts. But the opening was really, I think, the outstanding thing about it was the Sons of the Union Veterans and their regimental band playing period instruments and playing pieces of the American Civil War and also the Imperial Anthem. I was able to get a score from the Library of Congress, which was quickly emailed to the museum, and they played it just beautifully. And, of course, there were a few speeches from the heads of the museum here, the American-Russian Cultural Foundation, and the museum directors from Russia. There were three of them.
We will talk more about the exhibition and talk about the lives of Russian Tsar Alexander II and of Abe Lincoln as they're traced together in this traveling exhibit, which is mounted at the Oshkosh Public Museum through the 12th of October. We'll have more information, and you can get more information if you go to oshkoshmuseum.org. Coming up to the news, we'll be back with more with David McDonald and Marilyn Sweezy after a look at the news here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. He'll be back with us tomorrow. We've been talking about the Tsar and the President, Liberator and Emancipator, with Marilyn Sweezy of Washington, D.C., as one of two curators of a traveling exhibit at the Oshkosh Public Museum through the 12th of October, which traces the lives of Abe Lincoln and Russian Tsar Alexander II, and with David McDonald, who's professor of Russian history and chair of the History Department at the UW Madison. David McDonald, pleasure to have you with us here in studio.
Always fun to be back, Jim.
And Marilyn Sweezy, thank you so much for spending time with us there.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure.
The exhibition has artifacts that relate to both President Abraham Lincoln and Russian Tsar Alexander II. Tell me a little bit about what visitors to this exhibition will see as they walk through.
Well, as they walk through, they will see a representation of each of them, the Tsar and the President, not only in their official personas, but also in their domestic life. We have personal effects of Lincoln than we do of Alexander, part of the reason being that Russia was quite a bit ahead of us at that time in terms of its wealth and organizing of such artifacts as things that belong to the Tsar. But we do have, from Lincoln, we do have a White House chair. We have his cane. We have his personal seal. We have some handwritten notes written by him, photographs, some of them perhaps not seen before, campaign and election memorabilia. We have a piece of the White House porcelain and many other things as well. For Alexander, we have one of his uniforms. We have his briefcase, a really magnificent Mother of Pearl desk set. We have a beautiful Mother of Pearl cathedral clock that belonged to him, and icons that were in his rooms, including his so-called measurement icon. This is a very wonderful piece. It's a gilded icon of his patron saint, Saint Alexander Nevsky, made in the length of Alexander at birth. He was apparently around 19 inches long.
Mm-hmm.
This was an ancient tradition, and we do see these measurement icons, Mirny Ikony, as we say in Russian, particularly in the Kremlin Museum, has some wonderful examples. There are some beautiful portraits done of him and his family, coronation paintings, porcelain sets from the palace, some really beautiful things, and a very interesting original photograph of Alexander II at his desk in the Winter Palace. This is a photograph that has been published before, but when you see it in an original copy, you can see many objects in this painting, including a very large, very beautiful portrait of Empress Maria Alexandrovna that we actually have in the exhibition. It can be seen just behind his desk where he's sitting. So I should mention also that there are several layers to this exhibition. It's not only the parallels between these two leaders, but also the connection between them. Russia and America really became very friendly during this period. There was a real entente cordiale that developed at that time, and that's another rather important part of this story. The Tsar and the President never actually met, but they corresponded. And they certainly met on the equal footing of good diplomatic rhetoric. I don't think many people know that there are actually 21 letters written by Alexander II to presidents of the United States in our national archives, six of them written to President Lincoln. And we do have a very good facsimile. Of course, the originals are a little too fragile to exhibit, but we do have very good facsimile of one of the letters that Alexander II wrote to President Lincoln, written in French. The original was written in Russian, and then there was always a French translation with it. We have one of those on view, along with a handwritten draft, again a facsimile because of the fragility of the original, a handwritten draft written by Lincoln with words crossed out and signed in a very friendly way, "Your good friend, A. Lincoln." Alexander signed all of his letters, "Your good friend, Alexander."
I did not know that. Marilyn Sweezy of Washington, D.C., and David McDonald, our guests today. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 1-800-642-1234. I should say that the Oshkosh Public Museum is located on Algoma Boulevard in Oshkosh. The museum is open Monday through Saturday from 9 to 5 and Sunday noon to 5. And you can find out more about this display at OshkoshMuseum.org. You'll also find out about an exhibit that opened this past weekend called Survivor, Civil War Soldier. And this exhibit features 14 interactive challenges for kids of all ages to try their hand to see if they could have survived as a Civil War soldier. Those challenges include sending telegrams, decoding messages, drumming, and much more. So that's another exhibit that is open, and you're invited, of course, to see it at the Oshkosh Public Museum. One of the things, David McDonald, that you mentioned as the news was going on was the what was going on in Russia in way of opening up things to serfs and the political development that was going at that time.
Well, what really happened? It's an interesting and in many ways problematic outcome. One parallel that that I imagine Marilyn Sweezy would agree with between the two countries is that for all that the joint emancipations appear to be watersheds, the consequences of them and the difficulties faced by each society in absorbing and accepting the consequences of them continue to affect us right down to the present day. That in Russia, peasants were generally seen as pre-modern, as primitive, as unable to cope on their own. One of the reasons the government goes through with the emancipation is the feeling that they are no longer, you can no longer entrust them to the arbitrary authority of landlords, that only a well-constituted rational state power could take in hand the governance and the education and development of this part of the population. But the consequence was a policy called tutelage that really led to a sort of legal apartheid that governed most peasants right down. And the peasant issue is a continuing problem right down to World War I through the revolution and until Stalin resolves it in a typically brutal and high-handed manner in the 1930s. The peasantry and the whole question of emancipation became a point to which people kept returning. After Alexander's assassinated in 1881, his son tries really to undo a lot of the abolition of serfdom, but other reforms, or to limit other reforms that Alexander II had brought about, to the extent that they attributed the assassination to the liberalizing folly of the generation of bureaucrats that had dominated during Alexander II. But in a similar way, it seems to me the United States, after a period of reconstruction, which appears very hopeful, we see by the 1890s the ambivalence about the emancipation of African descended slaves with the institution of the regime we usually understand as Jim Crow. And it really takes legally until the 1960s for the iniquities of that regime to be undone, and arguably society is still processing that.
Marilyn, anything more to add on that question?
Well, I certainly would agree with that. It was a continuing problem, and I think just on the verge of World War I, between 1905 and 1914, Russia actually had made a great deal of progress in reducing infant mortality and in education of people, and of course the Stolypin reforms, providing independent farms and subsidizing independent farmers, was beginning to make some real success when he was assassinated, and then soon after that began World War I, and of course Stalin just liquidated that whole class. These were the kulaks that were liquidated by Stalin. So it has been a hard road indeed up to the present on both sides.
When you think about the efforts that were going on in Russia, was Alexander seen as a leader in this emancipation of the serfs, or was he dragging his heels, much as Abe Lincoln dragged his heels through the slavery issue?
Yes, in a sense he was, because I don't think he had the full support of the nobility. I think he just pushed forward because, as he said in one of his speeches, if we don't liberate them from above, it will come from below in a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So he understood that it was something that had to be done in spite of the reluctance of the upper echelons of his society, and much as the way Lincoln understood it, I think, in much the same way. He was trying to be very diplomatic, but at the same time absolutely committed to the emancipation of the slaves, however he could do it.
In this context of the letters back and forth between Lincoln and the Tsar, David, do you know what they were writing back and forth about?
I'll defer to Marilyn Sweezy, but it would
yes.
seem to me that likely the aftermath of the Crimean War, where Russia finds itself isolated, there's maritime agreements that restrict Russian activity. Also, Russia's strapped financially. But let's not forget that in 1867, Russia sells to the United States of America a not inconsiderable piece of territory called Alaska. And so I would imagine some of the correspondents would concern that. But Marilyn, you've seen these letters.
I have, David. I've gone to the National Archives, and I have looked at each one of them. And you will be surprised to hear that none of the above appears
Oh, really?
In any of these letters. they are very friendly. The whole first page of Alexander's letter is just the listing of his titles.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second page is the message. And the message is either the response to a letter from either President Lincoln or before or after him, announcing the recall of one of our envoys from St. Petersburg and praising him for his role at court, that is, the envoy who is departing, and speaking about how forward Russian-American relations are going and how good they are. And some letters are just a very friendly, almost familial announcement of the birth of a son. For instance, one of the letters was the announcement of the birth of his son, Grand Duke Paul. Another, the announcement of another son in the imperial family born to his brother, Grand Duke Constantine, who was very much a supporter of the
mm-hmm.
policy toward the United States and certainly of the liberation as well. He was probably much more liberal than Alexander in his thinking, as far as we know. So these letters, of course, are the tip of the iceberg. Underneath is an absolutely fascinating correspondence that I hope we, that is, scholars and researchers in the field of Russian history, can do something with. They were a fascinating discovery for me, and we have some of these letters coming from the State Archives and the State Historical Museum as well in Moscow, and I'm sure the State Department has some as well. That is the correspondence, voluminous correspondence, between the Russian minister in Washington, a man named Eduard de Steckel, who was here for some 37 years until right after the sale of Alaska, and back to Prince Gortchakov, who was another figure that has really emerged as someone of great interest. We don't know anything much about him in English language histories of Russia, but he's certainly quite prominent in Russian. We have a wonderful portrait of Prince Gortchakov and his portrait badge, which he earned with the double portrait of the Tsar Alexander II and also Alexander III, two emperors whom he served. He was a very eminent statesman, a scholar of history, who wrote letters back and forth not only to de Steckel, but to Mr. Clay, who was one of our ministers in Russia, and to Secretary of State Seward. These men were actually quite closely in contact. Edward de Steckel, who did travel back and forth from Russia to Washington, reported everything he saw and observed in the United States back to Prince Gortchakov. Prince Gortchakov showed these letters to Alexander II, and the replies from St. Petersburg to Steckel here in Washington often carried the Tsar's notation, so be it, or I agree. In one case, he said, bravo. And the letters between Steckel and Seward also, we have a few of those which are in our State Department, are very, very interesting. The archive of the Foreign Ministry of the Russian Empire in Moscow also has a number of these documents, which they submitted to us for our consideration. We would love to have had some of them in the exhibition. It didn't work out to bring them. They are, of course, in Russian, but I have used some of the translations of excerpts that we received in the catalog and on some of the labels. Very much promoting good relations with the United States. And, of course, another event that is very little known here and there was the visit of the Russian fleet to the United States in 1863, a rather critical time in our history. The fleet appeared in New York Harbor and also in San Francisco. They remained here for 7 months. One of the ships, the Oslabya, came down to Washington, to the port of Alexandria, and Mrs. Lincoln went aboard to meet the Russian officers. We have some photographs and documents connected with that visit. Everyone in the United States, beginning with President Lincoln, looked upon this visit as a tangible link of the support that was definitely expressed in these documents of the Tsar for the cause of the Union. Whether that was really the case or not, scholars still are not sure. Going into the archives in Russia, it is still not clear if there was any other reason. There probably was, but at the same time, Alexander II certainly knew that he was sending the fleet to the United States at a critical time for the support of the Union, and the presence of these ships certainly prevented anything coming from England or France in support of the Confederacy. And in addition, we sent a reciprocal naval mission back to St. Petersburg, back to Russia, in 1866, although it was after the time of Lincoln, after his death. It nevertheless was in the wake of this relationship, this entente cordiale between the Tsar and the President. And Deputy Secretary of the Navy, Gustavus Fox, was the leader of the mission. He traveled all over Russia. He was greeted with great enthusiasm and many receptions, as were the Russian officers and sailors when they were here. The stories that appear in Harper's Weekly, and we have some of these in the exhibition, are really remarkable. In spite of the Civil War, they had a magnificent ball in New York at the Academy of Music. The Admiral Lisovsky of Russia urged them not to do this because it was wartime, but they said, no, we have to do it, and they did do it. And Gustavus Fox was received everywhere in Russia. He made a very interesting comment. The collection of gifts that he received, including a portrait box, a snuff box from the emperor surrounded by diamonds, the portrait, which is in storage in the Smithsonian, unfortunately. We were not able to borrow any of these items because of the reconstruction going on now at the American History Museum of the Smithsonian. But Gustavus Fox received these magnificent things and was received everywhere with such enthusiasm. He said when he came back, "I feel like a bee wandering among the flowers."
It sounds like a wonderful exhibition, and you've described things that none of us have had a chance to see, and it should be an outstanding time to be viewing this exhibition. We had an emailer from Boyd in Milwaukee who wanted to know that if England and France had recognized the Confederacy during the war, where would that have left Russia? It apparently, David, is that Russia made known its intentions.
Yeah, no, Marilyn put it quite well, that one of the political gestures associated with the visit of the Imperial Fleet to the United States, this was a way to counter British and French sympathies towards the Confederacy, and a way of reasserting Russia's interest in being regarded as an international player after the debacle of the 1850s. So, and it's part of a general revival of Russian activity in Europe and in Central Asia during these years.
The Oshkosh Public Museum on Algoma Boulevard, the first museum in the world to concurrently showcase this collection of both Imperial Russian artifacts and Lincoln memorabilia. Where will this travel to next, Marilyn?
It will go to Kansas City, Missouri, to the Kansas City Museum Center. It will open there on November 1st of this year.
Mm-hmm. But it's good in Oshkosh until the 12th of October.
That's right.
And again, the Oshkosh Public Museum, founded in 1924, housing artifacts, photos, film, and archival material that represents the material culture, ideas, and values of Oshkosh and the Lake Winnebago region. And this exhibition of the Tsar and the President is a traveling exhibit that is occurring at the Oshkosh Public Museum through the 12th of October. Many of the Russian pieces have never traveled outside the country. Marilyn, we thank you so much for spending time with us today, and look forward to seeing your work.
Thank you so much, Jim. I hope people will go to see the exhibition, and I'm sure they will enjoy it.
Marilyn Sweezy of Washington, D.C., is guest curator of the exhibition The Tsar and the President. She is an independent art historian and curator specializing in Russian decorative art and cultural history. And we thank her for spending time with us today. David McDonald, professor of Russian history, chair of the history department at the UW-Madison, recently returned from a visit with his parents to Russia. What was the single most outstanding memory of that trip for you?
I would have to say that there's a monastery that has been refurbished in northern Russia that was very critical for the first six centuries of Russian history up until the 1700s, and I had not seen it before, and it was extremely impressive, especially when one realized all that had happened there.
David, thank you so much. We look forward to another visit from you.
I will too. Thanks,
David McDonald, professor of Russian history, chair of the history department at the UW-Madison. Coming up tomorrow, Larry's back. He'll be talking with Jeffrey Glassberg of Morristown, New Jersey, who is the author of Butterflies Through Binoculars. And tomorrow at 11:45, Glenn Lloyd of Wisconsin's Consumer Protection says, get your cell phone numbers on the Do Not Call list. That's coming up tomorrow. And on Thursday, Phil Pelletieri, UW-Madison entomologist, will be here to talk about bugs and insects on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.